The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am but one of your hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I'm another one of your hosts, Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And I'm the final host today, Michael Scavarla of Penn State University.
If we were Rudolph characters, I think I would be Santa, Jody, you would be Rudolph, and I want to say Mike is Yukon Cornelius. We're doing kind of a holiday special here, right?
I better be Yukon Cornelius. I'm going to have to take this up with the manager if I'm not.
And we're very excited because we're joined in our polar studio today by a special guest. Special guest, would you like to introduce yourself to the Arthropod crowd?
Absolutely. So my name is Chris Hayes. I'm a second year PhD student at NC State University in entomology, the best field there is.
Yay!
That's right. I like hearing that. Yeah, you've rocketed to the top of the guest list here so far. If you were a character from Rudolph, who would you want to be? Since I've assigned the other two, I don't know you well enough to pick.
That's a good question.
Double up if you feel like.
Okay, I will double up. You know, sometimes I feel like I could be the abominable snowman, depending on my mood, right? Oh. Lack of coffee, when I'm hungry, those kind of things. But then sometimes I feel really helpful, like the elf. I don't remember the elf's name.
Hermie.
What was his name?
Hermie, right?
Hermie. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Hermie. I'll accept that one.
He wants to be a dentist.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
You know. A dentist of bugs.
Yeah. I mean, they've got mandibles. They need teeth cleaning.
Yeah.
This is already off the rails. And I hope that everybody appreciates it. We're very excited to have you on the show, Chris. I am going to kind of let Jody talk about a little bit about the genesis of this interview and talk a little bit about how you two met, because I think it's an awesome story.
Well, I mean, I told you I can only say my perspective and my reality might not be the same as Chris's, but we met at this magical place called Pest World.
Oh, yes.
And I feel like it was pretty serendipitous because I was not feeling like I fit in there and I was really tired, but you made the 33 and a half hours that I was in Las Vegas pretty complete and changed the course of those hours after I met you. So, you know, I stuck around. I don't even remember who introduced us.
I feel terrible. I don't remember her name, but she is one of PyKai's head people who kind of organizes things behind the scene. She had tripped earlier in the day and was walking with a cane. Like she was coming out of a seminar and like tripped over a row of chairs. I don't remember her name though. I feel terrible.
Okay. I feel terrible too. So she's amazing because she introduced us.
Yes.
So it was a PyKai Omega mixer. So it was a social gathering. She introduced us because you were a scholarship winner and an intern working there. And we started talking. I think I mentioned something about extension. You mentioned an awesome podcast. I asked which podcast and you said it was this one. And then you were like the most amazing person in the whole entire world.
Yeah, that's my recollection too. I was really excited to tell you about it.
And then, so you know us from this podcast and you still want to be a guest.
Absolutely.
I don't know what you're implying, Jody. We don't run people through the gauntlet or anything here.
No, but people have been not as excited. How about that?
I also wanted to say, Chris, that Jody was texting Mike and I kind of live updates from Pest World. And yeah, it seemed to absolutely make her life to meet a real life person that listened to our podcast. So I appreciate that you spoke up and told her about it. I thought it was a great story. It's like the beginning of a Hallmark movie, honestly. I'm not saying like you guys are destined to get engaged or something at Christmas time, but
we're both married.
Yeah.
To other people.
Right. But you ended up on a podcast, which I think is a very platonic Hallmark movie they should make.
Yes, but it was, I agree.
Yeah. But it was not like, hey, I saw you. I want to be on your podcast. I mean, you've done some really great work. You will be something pretty amazing in this industry. I absolutely believe it. So I think we should talk about what brought you into entomology. First of all, I think there's so many things that we can talk about. I'm not the best when it comes to putting things in an order. So if you want to start with, I don't know, how you came to be who you are right now and what you're studying.
Yeah, I'm happy to start. Mike, did you want to say something? I see his hand is always up.
I did. Just real quick about you two meeting. So you were telling her about the Arthropod podcast. Like, was there a point before like that you recognized her voice and were like, oh, that's Jody, I've heard her? Or was it like she said, oh, I do that podcast, and then it hit you all of a sudden? Like, how did that, like, how did the recognition hit you?
Yeah. So I got introduced to her and some other guy. I don't remember who the guy was that was kind of the third person in this conversation triangle. But, you know, Jody starts talking about extension, and the whole time I'm kind of thinking, like, she sounds familiar. Like, I've been to a lot of talks this week so far, and maybe I've heard her somewhere, or maybe we've met at a conference before. I don't know where, but she sounds familiar, but I couldn't place it. I'm not very good at placing things like that. But then when I mentioned the podcast, she's like, that's our podcast. I was like, oh my God, that's who you are. Like, that's why I recognize your voice. So yeah, there was some kind of subtle recognition before.
Nice. Yeah. I was just curious.
No, yeah. That's a good question.
So who are you?
Yeah.
that's a loaded question. My ask.
So I mentioned kind of at the top of the podcast, but I'm a second year PhD student in entomology. So I born and raised in North Carolina, kind of in the western part of the state. Most people would probably know where Boone is because that's where App State is. I grew up about 30 minutes down the mountain from Boone in a town called Wilkesboro. Wilkesboro is known as the birthplace of NASCAR, if you like racing, moonshine, if you like moonshine, and Lowe's Hardware, if you like hardware stores. So we kind of, you know, greet everyone across life.
What if I like all three? Is there a place that I can experience them all at the same time?
Wilkesboro. Come to Wilkesboro.
Okay.
You
know, all right.
That's the place for you. But yeah, so I grew up there. My grandfather or great grandfather was a moonshine runner. So kind of a long history of being in that area.
What? Mine too.
Say it again.
Mine too.
Really? Look at that small world.
That's awesome. So not North Carolina.
That's right. North Carolina. It's the place. So grew up there, first generation college student. My parents kind of just stayed in the area. My dad was an appraiser, or still is an appraiser, to be honest. He values land and homes. And my mom kind of worked odd jobs. So I finished high school, and I actually was able to get a scholarship to go to NC State. So they have a program at State, which North Carolina State is in Raleigh, North Carolina, for people who don't know. And that's the capital of North Carolina, for people who don't know. Not the biggest city. I think Charlotte, North Carolina is actually the biggest city in North Carolina, but not the capital. So I got a scholarship to go to NC State called the Park Scholarship. It's a full ride. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to pay for college. So I went with the intention of saving the planet with renewable energy. That was my goal. And then sophomore year of college, I ended up taking a parasitology course that just studied parasites of humans and animals. In that course, we talked about the fact that insects are the number one vector of parasites to humans. And that kind of led me into this interest in learning more about the field of entomology. So I took a course taught by Dr. Clyde Sorensen. I don't know if you guys know that name or not, but he's an amazing instructor at NC State in our department. And he taught a course, or still teaches a course, actually I'm TAing for him next semester, called Insects and People. And it's just this really fun kind of 1,000-foot high view of entomology and culture, society, food, kind of everything. And I fell in love with it. I started working as a kind of undergrad student in a lab managing mosquitoes. And then that has led me to everything else that occurred in life. So I worked for a pest control company for 2 years after graduating, and then decided I wanted to go back and get my master's in global health. And so I went to Duke University, which is in Durham, North Carolina, just down the road from Raleigh. After finishing that up in 2020, right when COVID hit, I was able to start my PhD at NC State, start with quotations around it, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But yeah, and that's me. And I'm here. I'm married to a lovely wife. Her name is Nikki, and we have two dogs, and we live in an apartment in Raleigh.
That's awesome. I love hearing stories like that, where there's a teacher that seems to kind of come in and help to get people into entomology. It seems like there's so many of those folks in our science. So I appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah, of course.
I like hearing too that, like, you had a break in there between some of your degrees. You have this non-traditional path of coming to the research in your interests that you are doing. Because, like, me and John went straight through, and that's not the case for everybody. And I think some people will maybe feel discouraged going back to school. Like, I'm too old for that. So I like having people on that break that mold and show you can get back into it if you want to pursue a higher degree later on. Not that you're old now, but like you had a break.
One of my committee members just called me old the other day, looking at a picture that I took 2 years ago. And he's like, oh, is this your undergrad picture? I was like, no, that's the day I started my PhD. And now I look like this.
It's been a hard 2 years. Let's be frank, right? Like,
It has.
We've packed a lot in since 2020.
It's been a lot. And what's funny, Mike, you mentioned that I actually almost totally forgot research in between undergrad and my master's. So my wife and I decided right after we got married in 2015, right after I graduated, and we decided to work with a nonprofit serving refugees from Syria, Afghanistan, and Iran and Iraq. And we decided just to pack up and leave the country and move to Germany. And the goal was to live there. And we would have if we had been able to get visas, but we weren't able to get a visa because so many refugees needed a place to stay. So we came back. So, but I'm still involved with that group, and I've gone to Indonesia as well, working with that nonprofit.
That's very cool.
It's fun. It was a great experience. Great experience.
How did you come up with that idea to do that?
Oh, that's a good question. So the idea was just kind of floated to us. So the group is called Acts of Mercy. I think it's through a church based somewhere in the United States. I'm not sure where, but the goal is just to reach out to displaced people and people groups who need support. And the main focus of it actually is like mental health counseling. So the idea that as you go through these traumatic experiences, they can feel like these massive boulders, these massive weights kind of weighing you down. And we receive training in how to help encourage people to view those not as boulders that are weighing you down, but boulders you can use to build a new foundation for your life. And so maybe you're displaced, maybe you're no longer in your home country, and that sucks. But how can we help you as a community rally together, support one another, and really lay down a new foundation? Because the reality is this might be where you're at now because of those unfortunate experiences in your home. So it was great. And so I don't remember exactly how it got floated to us, but we kind of heard about it, and both of us just really have a passion for people and just really supporting people where they are. And it's funny, our first apartment was in a really rough part of Raleigh. Our apartment was $600 a month, fully furnished in Raleigh, which is crazy. And we got it for such a good deal because the previous tenants had a German roach infestation that was awful. And so the housing company like gutted the entire apartment and redid the whole thing. And so our neighbors were from Syria. And they would talk to us all the time kind of about their experiences and the struggles they had gone through. And so I'm certain that those neighbors, they didn't know it, but I'm certain that those neighbors really influenced us to do that. So
it sounds like a lot of what goes on in your life is centered around health, not necessarily just the exclusive sort of entomology aspect, which we hear about from a lot of our guests. You're really bringing in this human component, which I find fascinating. I know in my life as an extension professional, I wish I had the training that you were just describing about being able to sort of break down the big boulders and help people to see what challenges could be opportunities and what challenges they need to try and overcome more. Where did you get that kind of training? I mean, that sounds like an interesting experience. Was that part of your undergrad or where did you end up with that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I kind of got introduced to global health in undergrad. So there was this budding program at NC State. And we actually, I don't know her position now, but it was under another one of these instructors that really kind of shaped my life. Her name is Dr. Julie Cassani. And she taught just a really basic global health course that I took kind of as an elective. And I loved it. And it really started me asking these questions, kind of what health matters to people. Is it physical? Is it mental? Is it emotional? You know, are there aspects of, for example, spiritual health? How does this all come together to make a whole person, a complete person? And how can we cater to those things? And so then I kind of stepped back from the academic side of things and got the field side of things in pest control, right? Looking at how different pest insects can affect people with allergies, asthma, those kind of things, right? Like heavy buildup of frass from German roaches, for example. And that made me kind of interested in this communication of health to the public and working with people as opposed to just kind of the overhead level of health, right? Kind of the policy, the decision-making. I was more interested in kind of the hands-on to the people kind of thing. The real, I think, practical training came at Duke University in my master's. So it was a master's in global health. Amazing program. So it's called the Duke Global Health Institute. And it's just this massive amalgamation of researchers and professors who any topic under the umbrella of health, you'll find someone there that does it. Whether it's policy, funding, non-communicable diseases like cancer or diabetes or infectious disease, or even kind of emerging zoonotic disease, right? Like things like Ebola and stuff. So there's this kind of amazing backdrop of support there, and you take courses and you do all this stuff. You gain this technical knowledge and this experience, but the kind of linchpin of the program is that they require you to travel abroad. And so you get this international health experience as part of the master's program, and they require it. And so they pay for it. So they give you about $8,000 to cover that trip abroad to do your research. Now your research is funded by a mentor who you're working with. That is where I really got the largest bit of this training. And then everything else has kind of just been through kind of my own pursuit of what I'm passionate about.
Cool. Sounds like I need to enroll NC State probably sometime soon.
Yeah, North Carolina, NC State, Duke. We have a lot of good schools. Not Chapel Hill so much, though. You know, I've got
okay. I'll avoid the Tar Heels. Yeah,
that's right. Avoid.
Yeah. They have fake degrees anyway.
Yeah.
Can you discuss what your master's project was then?
Yeah, absolutely.
You get to pick that. Did you get to develop that, or was that something that was developed prior to you?
Yeah. So as with, I think, most things in my life, I kind of took a non-traditional path for that. The way I'll talk about the program first, the way the program is supposed to be set up is you come in as a first year master's student and you take kind of the introductory course in your first semester. And during that first semester, the goal is for you to really figure out what you want to do in health. And then they match you with a mentor. And then the two of you work out a project during that first semester. And then you finish it the next three semesters. That is not what I did. So when I went into the program and committed, they had like a summer event where you could come and meet your cohort as well as some of the instructors there. And I had a background in entomology, very minor, but a background in entomology, right? With pest control and then an undergrad with mosquitoes. So I found that there was really only one person who was working on kind of malaria from the entomology side of things, but they didn't have an entomology background. And so my thought was, well, maybe I can bring that entomology perspective. It's really budding. I don't have a lot of experience, but what I do have seems like more than what they have. So maybe I can bring that into this. And so that was Dr. Miang Nyant, and she is Burmese. That's the name. Her name is actually Miang Miang Nyant. And I met with her that summer and we just kind of hit it off. And the opportunity to travel and work in a country like Myanmar that is so remote, so kind of off the radar for most people, especially entomologists, I feel like, unless you're in this kind of niche group of malaria-focused entomologists, or I guess maybe a couple other infectious diseases, but there's not a whole lot of work to be done in Myanmar from an entomologist perspective, right? And so there's just this amazing opportunity to go. And so the whole project centered around understanding the ecology of Anopheles mosquito vectors of malaria in Rakhine State. And so Rakhine State is western part of the country. So it's coastal. I would say most people know it from the news with the Rohingya Muslim crisis. So there's a lot of persecution in that state of Rohingya Muslims by the Buddhist majority. It's a very complex, difficult area to work in. There is active conflict continuously in that area between the military and local militia. And foreigners are generally not allowed in that part of the country. So I was very lucky to have been allowed. I guess that kind of gets off topic a bit. But yeah, so the project was focused on Anopheles mosquito ecology in that area.
I don't think that's off topic at all. You were kind enough to send your master's thesis, and I read through probably 90% of it. I mean, it was really good. But I did notice there was one month in there that, you know, there was no collections made. And the little star by the, I think it was July, maybe.
Yeah.
The little star by it said, you know, collections couldn't be made because of like internal conflict or
yeah,
you know, it wasn't safe to be there.
Yeah.
So I think one, I think that's really neat that you are working in a place that is typically avoided because of conflict and in danger and whatnot. Many entomologists would just be like, well, I'm not going there, period.
Yeah.
In helping serve that community like that. But I think that had a direct impact on your research. So that is extremely relevant.
Yeah. I think personally, I am drawn to working internationally in areas that are more conflict prone. I think one of the number one things I took away from my program in global health is that internal conflict and disease kind of go hand in hand. And so in the wake of internal conflict, you oftentimes have either increased areas for vectors to breed and to spread. You have loss of access to medicine access to roads, infrastructure, and you have difficulty with distribution of what people need. And so it kind of makes this perfect storm for example, like a last bastion of malaria transmission, right? Are in these areas of active conflict. And so I think I think it makes perfect sense. And my wife agrees with me, but is also stressed sometimes, right? It makes perfect sense to think that in an area of active conflict, you don't want to be there, especially when as a foreigner, and in my case, as a white foreigner, right, you stand out. And we got stopped probably 4 or 5 times by people while I was there, by the military and militia asking, who am I? Why are you here? You know, what are you doing in Rakhine? Obviously, it makes sense you wouldn't want to go to those places. But I think it's areas of the world where conflict is ongoing that really need the most support from the research community who's willing to go, right?
I have a feeling that holding up bugs too is probably like not the passport, like not the easiest of passports to be like, I'm here to do entomology work. Exactly. I would be suspicious of that as well.
Yeah, I was with some amazing, amazing collaborators and just support staff who they just essentially said, shut up, Chris, we'll talk and you'll be fine. And one of them, her name is Ma Chin. So Ma is kind of the honorific for an older woman. Okay. I don't know her name other than Ma Chin, but she was amazing, an amazing, amazing just support in that part of the country. And everyone there knew her. The people we worked with knew her. The people who wanted to know who I was knew who she was. And so with her vouching for me, it made things a lot easier. But it definitely was not the easiest explaining. Right. It's a mosquito and this is why it matters.
Right. I appreciate your perspective on the conflict, though. I feel like we heard about that a lot with Mike. He did this whole expose on the history of Napoleon and insects. Yeah. And I mean, just all of the conflicts that, on the other side of that is disease and bugs and problems. Yeah. And I think Mike had a lot of fun parsing through that historically, but in real time, I imagine it's horrible, right? I mean, what can you do in a moment like that? I don't want to speak for Mike, though.
Looking at it historically, there's like a distance factor that allows it to be interesting. A lot of people died, and especially with the Napoleonic conflict, it's hundreds of thousands of people, and it's like that is just a statistic. But the Rohingya crisis in the last 9 months or a year since the military staged the coup in Myanmar, people are actively being killed right now on the ground.
It's rough,
and you can't distance from that the way I could.
It's much more in your face.
Yeah. I don't have any broader insights, but that's got to be tough.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really, that I think that's the, speaking on Myanmar just a little more, I think that's the hardest part for me is a lot of the progress that has been made in that country over the past, 10-ish years, 5-10 years towards democracy, towards just kind of empowerment of the people, right? It's kind of just being ripped away. And a lot of the researchers, the families I got to know while I was there, I haven't heard from them in, a year. And the last time I heard from them, they were okay, but there's still this just, I don't know. Yeah, it's tough. It's tough to kind of be faced with it in the moment, for sure.
So what did you learn about the mosquitoes over there and the interaction between the people and the disease?
Malaria in Myanmar is kind of a complex situation. So just in case everyone listening doesn't know kind of how malaria works, just really briefly, malaria is a parasitic protozoan, and it's in the blood of a human is kind of where it wants to be. It is carried between humans via the bite of Anopheles mosquitoes. So Anopheles will feed on a human. They'll take up the transmissible stage of the parasite and they'll fly off, lay eggs, kind of go through their life cycle. And then as that adult female mosquito comes back to people to bite them again, she will then infect the next person. And there's a very specific life stage of the parasite that only takes place in the mosquito's body. And so that's why, apart from just the mosquitoes transmitting it to people, getting rid of the mosquito or understanding that mosquito vector and ecology can help us better understand kind of that piece of the life stage and try and cut that off and stop that if we can control the vector, right? And so what we did kind of practically is we took the land in the communities where I was working, and we kind of from satellite imagery divided up the land cover type based on factors like tree cover, shrubs. So some examples, we had natural forest, we had built structures, we had water bodies and wetlands, rivers. All in all, I think we had 8 to 10 land covers. I don't remember the exact number. Maybe Mike knows the exact number because he just reread the thesis. But
I think you had 8 types of land cover, but I don't have to look.
That's okay. So we had 8 land cover, and the idea was we're going to put out these traps across kind of the end of the monsoon season into the dry season. So kind of this falling off of water, right? And we're going to collect across these land cover and see a couple things. Ideally, we didn't get to do all these things, but ideally what we wanted to do was, do we see changes in mosquito abundance by land cover? So where are the anopheles at throughout the year? Are we finding them in the same place consistently, or does that fluctuate over time? What species are we finding? So sequence what mosquitoes we catch, see what we find. And then what mosquito species have malaria? So that last bit we didn't get to do. We didn't get to check the mosquitoes for malaria because a year and a half is not a lot of time to do all of that, right? And that's something I didn't know going in as kind of an optimistic master's student. I'm like, oh, I have enough time to do all of the things I want to do. And unfortunately, I didn't. What we noticed kind of unsurprisingly, I think, is that consistently throughout our study period, the most mosquitoes were collected in and around communities, right? Or anopheles specifically were collected in and around communities, which that makes sense. One of the reasons that's interesting and a little different than kind of what we may have expected in part is a lot of these communities work as kind of migrant lumber workers. And so there's this interaction between one specific anopheles species, which is Anopheles diris, which is kind of a forest fringe dwelling mosquito. And that's kind of the dominant vector throughout much of Southeast Asia. And so kind of the general acceptance is that wherever Anopheles diris is present, it's going to be the dominant vector. And so that means it's just the dominant mosquito that transmits the disease to people, right? We didn't notice that many mosquitoes in the natural forest area. And so we wanted to take those mosquitoes and we sequence them. And when we sequence them, and again, you know, there's questions about kind of how this data looked, and there's still some extra kind of confirmation that we need to run with it, because we did have one species pop up that was kind of unexpected and we're not really sure why that happened. What's interesting and what it looks like is, well, we didn't see those. We didn't see kind of this Anopheles diris or Anopheles minimus. And instead we saw 11 different species of Anopheles just in these built structure near residence land covers. I think 9 or 10 of those 11 different species of mosquitoes have been shown to be opportunistic vectors of malaria. And so it kind of diversifies this ecology, right? Instead of just having a single mosquito that could transmit the disease to people, we now potentially have 10 or 11 different species, and their biting times might be slightly different. That there have been studies showing that kind of in response to vector control measures, some vectors, especially in Africa, are biting much earlier or biting much kind of later in the night or further into the morning when you're going to be out from under the bed nets that might be used. So yeah, it's just a really interesting study. I would like to go back and do more. And now that I have a little bit more research kind of development experience and project development experience, I think it could be done better. And I think it could be done more kind of more powerfully, if that makes sense.
So what do they do? You mentioned bed nets. Is that the main source of, I guess, pest management they use to avoid getting malaria?
It's a good question. I guess I probably should have started with that just to kind of give a background. But there are a few ways you can kind of control malaria in a community, right? One of them is going to be prophylactic treatment. So if they are infected with malaria, you want to treat that person to get rid of that infection. But if you treat the person and get rid of the infection, but you don't control the disease in the community or the mosquito vectors, the person can just get it again, right? With the way parasites work, you don't really develop immunity to them after getting infected. Certainly over time with repeated infection in some of these communities, you see that people don't really have a severe reaction, right? So whereas if I went into a community and got malaria tomorrow, I would probably have a horrible reaction because I have no kind of built up recognition. But someone who has had malaria quite a few times, they can get even what we call asymptomatic malaria, where they contract the parasite, their body has a reaction, but it's not a severe enough reaction to cause them to become symptomatic. And so they don't get treatment. So once you treat and get rid of the disease, the other half of it is you need to control the vector. And so since there isn't really a reliable vaccine yet, which hopefully is going to be changing in the near future, there's been some advancement there. But the best way to do that, and historically the best way we have done it, is through controlling of the mosquitoes. And so the way that that has been done historically was through, for example, widespread use of DDT outdoors to kill mosquitoes in the United States, oiling of breeding habitats, which is terrible for the environment. And so to come up with a better way of doing it, we developed what are called long-lasting insecticide-treated nets, LLINs, or insecticide-treated nets, ITNs, kind of depending on where you read about it. And those are just very straightforward. It's a fabric that is woven and impregnated with a pyrethroid insecticide. And people then put those around their beds and they'll sleep under them. And so those pyrethroid insecticides, as they volatilize, they kind of create this repellency effect of the mosquitoes. And so if for some reason the mosquitoes touch the pyrethroid, generally the idea is they die, but more likely than not, they're going to be repelled by that net and they won't bite the person. And so then the kind of hand in hand piece with that is an indoor residual spray, which is going to be just a pyrethroid applied to the interior of the home on the walls. And so as the mosquito leaves, if for example, they potentially did get a blood meal and they go rest, they land on that pyrethroid and die, or more likely they've been repelled by the bed net and they go land on the wall, they also die. So it's just kind of making sure that inside the home is as inhospitable to mosquitoes as possible. And so that once they enter there, they die. And so it's important to know what mosquitoes are biting and when, so that you can target those interventions to really, really crack down on malaria transmission in communities. So that's the reason that I was doing that study.
You mentioned you found 11 different species instead of just what, Anopheles diuris, the one that is common elsewhere. So
yeah,
do we know the biology of those 11 species? Like, are they breeding in different places? And like, are some of them landing indoors and others flying out and landing on trees and other places? Like, I imagine with 11 different species and 11 different biologies, you've got a lot more complicated system, but do we even know what those what they're doing? Because, you know, in a place like Myanmar, I imagine they might be understudied. And
yeah,
the one I did see, you found what, Anopheles quadrivaculatus.
Yeah.
That's using DNA, which is a North American species.
Yes.
And one of the things that you mentioned, one of the things that might've happened is it could be an undescribed related species because you're using like operational taxonomic units. So if you've got a new species, like, we don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
So like, how does that complicate what you're trying to do? And do we even know the basic information about these things to even put it to use?
Yeah, no, I think you're hitting the nail kind of on the head of some of those species that we found. There has been research into, and there has been a lot of research into some of them. For example, the maculatus complex. But even in that, we come into the issue of a species complex where they're incredibly similar species, but they don't interbreed, and they're very difficult to tell apart, but they can have very different behavior. And so the kind of mosquito ecology world of Rakhine State, specifically of that area in Myanmar, is incredibly complex. And the behaviors definitely can change. You know, I don't know the behavior of every species that we found. I didn't have time to really kind of dig into that, but they can. There are even some Anopheles mosquitoes that are container breeders. And so targeting traditional sites where you would expect Anopheles mosquitoes to breed wouldn't really be effective against those, right? So you would need to kind of bring in like an 80s mosquito targeting kind of approach to handle those container breeders. The quadrimaculatus point is kind of why at this point it has not kind of been published. There's this question of where did that come from? Could it be a new species that is just very similar to quadrimaculatus? Absolutely. Could it be from contamination from a North American species that we didn't know happened? Absolutely. We don't know. And so because I've kind of left and there's just been some kind of personnel turnover at Duke, that has kind of just been put on hold to answer that question. My hope is that I get to go back and answer that question. There's actually a paper that came out just like, I think maybe a month ago or within the last month, where someone or a research group essentially did this exact same study, but in Cambodia, which makes me incredibly jealous, you know, seeing the results of that published. I'm thinking, man, this is exactly what I wanted to get out of my master's work. And so my hope is I can get that at some point in the future. But right now I'm kind of, after talking with Kobe and thinking about the future, my eyes are kind of facing forward rather than back for now, but we'll see. One day I'd like to wrap back around in some way. It's a very complicated environment there, very complicated situation, but I think that makes it more fun.
It sounds like a lot of your world was mosquitoes for a long time.
Yeah,
you're not centered on them anymore. From what I know about Kobe Shaw's lab, I mean, you've probably transitioned to more of a, I guess, an urban pest perspective, which isn't to say that these two worlds are divorced necessarily, but
yeah,
I'm going to guess that you're thinking more about cockroaches and bedbugs lately.
Yeah. Yes. So that's a, it's kind of a complicated story, but I think a fun one. For now, the book is closed on mosquitoes. I don't know if it'll open back up. I think mosquitoes are fascinating. I love them.
Yeah. Book's open. I mean, that's by nature. We can go exactly. Back to them. Yeah,
exactly. So the transition to NC State was a weird one. Having been a first generation college student, I didn't have a whole lot of support going into kind of a PhD. I didn't really even know kind of how that would work. My mentor at Duke at the time, she was supportive of me doing it because she was an entomologist, I guess. She didn't really offer very much insight kind of into how the process worked. And so I kind of relied heavily on our postdoc at the time. And she is amazing. Her PhD is in chemistry, which is a very different field than entomology. And so I was kind of relying on kind of her experience, thinking about mine. And so I put in these applications. I was kind of between NC State and UC Davis. And I went to UC Davis and toured it. Loved the campus, loved the people. And I felt the same way about NC State. But at UC Davis, I couldn't find funding. There were plenty of people, plenty of professors who said, yeah, we'd like to take you on, but we just don't have any funding for you right now, which was fine. That's great. I kind of, I think Jody used this word at the beginning. I believe in serendipity a lot. And so I think there can just be the right time, the right place with the right people. And so I came back under the assumption that the way a PhD in entomology would work is they would circulate my application. And if a professor liked me, they would reach out to me. And I hadn't heard anything by April. And so I was kind of stressed out. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, I really want to do a PhD. So I reached out to Clyde Sorensen at NC State, who's the director of the graduate program, and Wes Watson, who is also kind of in charge of a lot of the graduate student stuff, and asked them kind of, what does this process look like? And their response was, well, you should be looking for someone. So I started this kind of flurry of emails of the professors I was interested in, but I hadn't heard back from yet. One of them being Kobe, saying, hey, I'm really interested in what you do. Like, do you have funding? Can we talk? And so Kobe is actually the first one I heard back from. And he said, you know, I'm not interested in taking on a student right now, but I'm really interested in what you've done and your background. Do you want to have a Zoom call? And so we had a Zoom call, and he pitched the idea to me over Zoom, this really cool intersection of malaria and bed bugs. And the idea being that in communities where, specifically in Africa here, it's probably the same in Southeast Asia, or at least some communities. I don't know that though, but definitely in Africa, people deal with bed bugs in rural communities in their homes all the time. And this has been published on quite a bit, actually. One of the reasons people accept bed nets for malaria control is kind of the immediate practical benefit over the long-term health benefits, right? So in a lot of communities where malaria is endemic, the older members of those communities, kind of middle-aged to older, they've had malaria many times in their life, and it's just kind of mild symptoms at this point. A lot of them don't have severe symptoms unless they develop what's known as cerebral malaria, which can be severely fatal. And so In these communities, the idea of sleeping under a bed net that makes it hot and stuffy, it's already hot, and now they're just going to be hotter. There are also some kind of cultural views about the circulation of air, like the spirit, kind of what happens to you when you sleep, that these bed nets can interfere with. They kind of don't even want to give you the time of day to think about it necessarily, right? And so there had to be this way of encouraging people to adopt bed nets. And the best way that has been shown kind of in the literature that I've seen so far was, hey, it kills bed bugs. It kills cockroaches. It kills body lice. It kills all these other things. Who cares about the mosquitoes? Just use it. It's really good. And people would say, okay, that's great. I'll use it. But what has started popping up, kind of starting back in, I think 2014, 2015 is the first paper I saw. And I think it was in Ethiopia, but it's been in several countries in Africa. And in the wake of bed net use, there's been this resurgence of resistant bed bug populations, or specifically bed bugs resistant to pyrethroids. And the question Kobe and I are asking now is, are bed nets potentially driving the evolution of insecticide resistance in bed bug populations in these communities? And then as a result of that, is this resistance in the urban entomology space potentially driving people out from under bed nets, causing a re-increase in these communities of malaria incidents or malaria infection? And there's been some kind of anecdotal research and mentions of, oh, this community stopped using bed nets because they blamed them for their bed bug problems. Or, you know, we saw a few people here who said they much prefer sleeping outside as opposed to sleeping in their bed where they now have like 2,000 bed bugs biting them. So we don't know, but that's what we're doing now. And so the transition has been interesting. I'm sure each of you can think back to kind of when you were starting your PhD. I think the most difficult part of the transition for me was maybe 3 or 4 months into starting with Kobe, my advisor at Duke just quit research. she just left the research space. Since that point, her and I have not really talked very much. She left two master students that had to be shifted to another mentor in their last year. She left a postdoc. I don't really even know what happened. But here I was, 3 months into knowing Kobe, having to explain to him, hey, the person who vouched for me the loudest is just gone. And having to navigate that was kind of wild, to say the least. So
that is a unique experience. Yeah. Especially when it's not that they went to another university or they're just harder to get a hold of or something. It sounds like they changed their career pretty drastically.
I think she's with the FDA now. I'm not sure though. I haven't heard from her in over a year at this point. And I tried, you know, I emailed her, I reached out, but nothing. It's kind of wild.
Well, I'm sorry you're going through that. I mean, I know, I'm guessing other people have said that, but that's hard. I mean, that's a hard thing. It's one of those artifacts of sort of the, I guess, the unfair politics or the unfair power dynamics of the graduate situation. It's something we've talked briefly about on the show, and I know have each talked about before privately, but I mean, professors, they hold all the cards, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes they fold and they leave people behind. That's hard. I'm sorry you're going through that.
I appreciate it. It's been a very refining experience.
I know one of your academic siblings, Dr. Zach DeVries, I work with him here at UK. So I know that you're working with a really excellent professor now at NC State. So I hope that things will get better and brighter. And your project, I mean, the marriage of that malaria stuff and the bedbug stuff, I think that's really cool. I made that joke a little bit ago about moving from medical entomology to urban entomology. But I do think those worlds are more interconnected than we sometimes like to believe in our siloed universes. So would you say that you're going at this at a One Health approach, or is that nomenclature that fits in your world?
Yeah. I love the kind of One Health framework. Yes. So I think I am. And I think that that's something kind of looking forward in my career, an approach I want to take in the future. You know, I'm not sure where I'll land, but I definitely think the One Health approach is something we need to consider because things are much more interconnected than I think they've been previously given credit for. So
maybe for our listeners, can you help unpack that One Health terminology? Just like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
For people like you and for our science in the future.
So One Health kind of takes this, the idea, at least from my understanding, is it's a term that incorporates the health of humans, the health of the planet, and the health of the environment / animals, really, really focused on animals, and kind of says that all of those pieces of health are integrated, and that a loss of health or a serious change in one of those three areas has ripple effects into the other two. And so this idea that specifically in this case, that the way we control malaria is solely by controlling mosquitoes is a very kind of singular health approach. Whereas the One Health approach would be, well, the way we control malaria is by understanding how changes in the environment impact malaria transmission, changes in other species impact malaria transmission, and changes in human behavior impact malaria transmission. And once we have that picture, we can approach it from a One Health kind of perspective and say, all right, how can we really get a handle on this? Otherwise, I think it's just like a seesaw, and we put quickly too much weight on one end of it, and then the other end goes up, and now we're trying to balance it back out, and it just becomes this fight against all these different things that we can't even see yet because we haven't looked.
Yeah, I like that. I like the way that you put it. It's something that, so I've been teaching an IPM course over the course of the semester, and we had Zach come in, and he did an urban entomology talk for us. And the students read a paper from, I think, the late 80s that was about aesthetic thresholds. And this idea that we've been talking about economic thresholds in the field a lot. What's an aesthetic threshold in a home? It was fascinating to hear our students. I think that they have this cool view that, or some of the older people in entomology don't necessarily have, that the aesthetic threshold doesn't take into account all these things. And it doesn't take into account this One Health approach. They were talking about One Health without really knowing what that verbiage was. So I think that what you're doing, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that's going to shape the future of entomology and help more people than, and not to say that things that we've done in the past are bad. I'm not here to denigrate, but realizing that, we went whole hog and killed all the mosquitoes and did all this and malaria got under control, but now bed bugs are rampant.
Yeah,
That's also a problem. So
yeah.
What do you think, Mike?
The terminology of One Health, I'm just becoming familiar with in the last year or two. And really it's because I've been collaborating with our wildlife entomologist here who does, you know, a lot of like medical, veterinary, wildlife, the intersection of all those things, which is often a One Health perspective.
Yeah.
But it's so intuitive. There's lots of different factors that go into affecting how insects affect transmission of disease between insects and humans and animals. And it makes such intuitive sense that until somebody spelled it out, I didn't realize that that's not what we were doing. Mm-hmm. Like, it seems silly that we haven't been taking a One Health approach this entire time, because like, why wouldn't you? And just kind of made me realize like, well, historically we haven't been. Something I picked up in your master's thesis, and I want to ask if and how you're applying it to your current research. You know, in science, especially in things like taxonomy, which I'm really familiar with, we have this problem with parachute science where Western scientists, you know, America, Canada, developed European countries, wherever, will go to a less developed country like Myanmar, like countries in Africa, collect their specimens, go home. They don't really ever incorporate any local scientists, local knowledge. They just parachute in and leave. Something I was really impressed with in your thesis was the idea of incorporating local scientists, transmitting, you know, the methods that you're using, specifically looking at molecular methods that they can use in country. Like, you didn't use QIAGEN kits for DNA extraction. You used somewhat older methods that a lot of Western scientists don't use anymore because they're difficult. And we have easier ways, but QIAGEN kits are expensive and you can't, I imagine, get them in Myanmar. And it also sounded like what you were doing was incorporated into some kind of larger project that was going on at Duke that had the goal of transmitting this technology and knowledge back to Myanmar. So I was really impressed with that. And I wanted to ask, now that you're working in another continent that has this legacy of Western scientists coming in and not really incorporating local people, is that a concern? Is that something you're taking into account? How are you dealing with that?
That's a great question. I am absolutely taking it into account. I'm kind of annoyed that COVID happened, as I think probably most people in the world are. So I came in to Kobe's lab and we had this project idea. And immediately I'm like, hey, I really want to collaborate internationally. Like, I don't just want to do this from this perspective. I want to make sure that we're including perspectives of people kind of on the ground that this research would impact. And so we did that. So we found collaborators, two in Tanzania and one in the Ivory Coast. And we had this plan and it was like, COVID's going to hopefully go away in a year. And I'm going to get to go to Tanzania and I'm going to get to go to the Ivory Coast, see what this is like on the ground, work hand in hand with these researchers, go into the field, understand their community, or at least try to understand their community, what part of it I could, right? See how they collect bed bugs, see how they go through this process, and really work with them to give ownership to these communities over the research and the results of it, and to give ownership to these collaborating institutions there. COVID is still around and has completely thrown that out of the window in terms of me going, but we still have one collaborator in Tanzania, and he is just so committed to this project, and he is amazing. His name is Dr. Ladislo Mignone. I hope I'm saying that right. I haven't actually got to talk to him yet. It's just been email, but he and his team are just so committed to kind of getting to the bottom of this and trying to understand what role bed nets are playing in this, if they are. And so right now, the way that looks kind of practically is we have provided them with sample collecting utensils, jars, like containers, reagents that they need to ship it, and have worked with them in kind of developing what an SOP looks like. Worked with them in selecting communities where they're going to go, and communities actually they're already going to be in working, and they're just kind of saying, hey, we're here, we can collect bed bugs, and then you guys can kind of look at them for us and see what you find. This is kind of part of their project, and we're kind of coming alongside them and helping support them in what they're doing. Just really this really beautiful alignment of desire and goal and vision here. COVID has made it a lot more difficult. Ideally, what I would like is kind of similar to my experience in Myanmar, where I go and I become as much a part of that community as I can as a foreigner. Obviously, there are limits as a foreigner to kind of how integrated you can become. Just because you're not from that community, you may not speak the language. There's a lot of the nuances that you just don't know. But I'm doing what I can. And hopefully, before I defend and finish in a few years, I'll have the opportunity to go. I don't know if I will, but my hope is that I will. And there was actually, additionally, this is kind of a side note, there was a whole side of my PhD I wanted to do that was in the social sciences. I wanted to do social interviews in communities to really gauge kind of risk perception about bed bugs, malaria, bed nets. And so I had developed this whole social science side of it, surveys, questionnaires. I had a social scientist on my committee. like we were so gung-ho about this. And then COVID has just continued to be kind of ever present right now, especially in countries and parts of the world where they're not as privileged to have access to vaccinations and things as we are here in the US. It's there, but it's not as much as I would like it because of kind of the world circumstances right now.
Chris, I have some questions about, I mean, because I'm urban entomologist and, you know, have a thing with bed bugs. How prevalent are they there? Do you know what the perception of bed bugs are? And I mean, even here, we talk about passive public health and they are, but they don't spread disease. So sometimes funding and there's always that blurry line. So how do they manage bed bugs or do they? Is it more accepted? Is it, you know, we've got a huge stigma here.
Yeah, I've run into the kind of urban entomology health issue. I've had the NIH shoot down a proposal twice now, unfortunately, but that's okay. I don't know firsthand what it's like, right? Because I haven't been. But from what I've read and what I've seen, my understanding is that bed bugs are kind of accepted as a part of life. They experience them in these communities, but there becomes kind of this, I think as Jonathan was saying, like this aesthetic value, right? This aesthetic level of it's too much. And so then at that point, there is treatment. From what I have read, there seems to be kind of two types of treatment. There's obviously like the chemical side of treatment, which I think is less frequent because that costs money, versus the kind of more cultural physical treatment, which may involve like carrying furniture outside and beating it off, kind of away off in the woods or something, or away from the home, trying to get as many bugs off as they can, those kind of things. But from what I have seen from our collaborators and just photos they have sent me, they're kind of everywhere. Like as they go into homes and they just start kind of pulling apart furniture, there are bed bugs. And if there aren't live bed bugs right there, there's at least some exuvia or clear signs that there was an aggregation there at some point. And I even have this really cool picture, which for me, I got it kind of at the beginning of this whole project. And it really kind of made me even more so commit to this. There's this really nice picture of adult bed bugs living within a malaria bed net. And so it was kind of this like light bulb moment of like, wow, you know, there it is. Now we just need to understand what that means for the bed bugs and what that's doing.
Cause it could easily be like this perception, like, oh, well, these nets, this is where the bed bugs live. I'm not going to use these nets anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess from that side of things, from what I have read, and this is also kind of from my experience in Myanmar a little bit, when you go into communities and as a Westerner, as an outsider, even with good intentions, you change something. If something negative happens after that change, whether it is directly associated with that change or not, you can have the blame of that change occurring on what you did, right? So that's kind of where the bed net thing comes in. The bed nets come in, bed bug populations go down, bed bug populations spike back up. What changed? Why I started using the bed net and now my bed bugs are worse than when I didn't have the net. It's the net's fault. I'm not going to use it, right? And the key here is a lot of these communities, these campaigns to roll out bed nets revolve around community support because communities have to buy the bed nets and they oftentimes need to pay out of pocket to treat them with pyrethroids every few years. And so it's up to the person to pay for it. And when you already have limited income, if you perceive this as having any negative effect, it's not going to get retreated, right? You're not going to waste the income on this thing that you think is negative for you. So yeah, it's complex, but it's fun.
I love your positivity. Yeah, I really do. Sure. So I was also in pest control and I learned a lot. Were you a pest control technician out in the field then?
Yeah, I was.
What kind of things did you learn from that, negative or positive, that has helped you along the way to want to push for research in this area?
I'm sure as many of you have learned, one of the first things I learned was that people are really bad at identifying insects, kind of just off the cuff, you know. It's either just all of it's a roach, none of it's a roach. You know, there's just like it's just the same thing. So that was kind of the first thing I noticed was, wow, you know, people have a really hard time identifying these insects. And it's just from a lack of education, right? And I think back on my time in elementary school, middle school, high school, there wasn't an entomology focused education. And I think, honestly, this is kind of a soapbox. I think there should be at least some level of urban ent education in middle school, high school era. Because even if you don't go into pest control or field of entomology, you can easily have urban pests in and around your home anywhere in the United States, right? And so I think there's just kind of this basic fundamental need to understand, just like I think it's good for people to know how to change oil in their car, like just kind of like a basic thing. You should know a roach from a bed bug from, you know, whatever. Anyway,
that should be in life skills.
Yeah. Yeah. That should be a life skills. That should be a life skills, you know,
in between right taxes and changing your oil.
That's right. That's right. We'll do taxes first. Then we'll do pest identification and then changing the oil.
Boiling an egg.
Exactly. Boiling an egg too. Absolutely. And kind of on the research health side of things, I just really fell in love with kind of communicating what I was doing to clients and customers. So explaining to them, well, why is it bad that you have this pest, or what does it mean to have this pest, right? For example, if I went into a home and the homeowner, very clean house, they don't have anything left out, but they suddenly have German roaches. They're freaking out, telling me I must be disgusting. I must be gross. Like I must need to do all of these things. There's this stigma associated with it. And I loved coming into the situation saying, hey, it is nothing you've done wrong. It could be that you went to a farmer's market and maybe you came home with something, or you went to a thrift store perchance and you got something that had an egg casing in it, or, you know, there's 100 different things that could have caused this infestation to be here. And there's no reason for you to sit here and beat yourself up about it, right? We're going to fix it. We're going to take care of it. We'll ultimately fix it. And just this human to human interaction. I think probably since midway through high school, I have viewed humans as honestly the most valuable resource we have on the planet, and just the unlimited potential of a person to accomplish whatever they set their mind to, right? Obviously, this is barring kind of cultural or structural or kind of societal limitations put on them that are outside of their control. But given kind of unlimited resource, the thing that people can accomplish. And I think one of the biggest restrictions of that is health. And that's kind of what I think narrowed me down this path of saying, well, how can I impact people's health? Medical school was not an option. I have never found myself fascinated enough with the human body to put myself through that level of pain. Then with my entomology knowledge and passion that I had started, I was like, okay, well, let's do the entomology thing. And that obviously is in both the urban space and the peri-urban space. So where we come into contact with these insects the most. So
I listened to your NC State TEDx talk. The title of it is Leaving a Legacy: The Realities of Conducting Research in Complex Areas. Basically, what I took away from it is that you are just such an insightful, positive person that really wants to make a difference. It was very reflective on something that you said earlier, like we have the capability and the potential to change so many things. Do you want it to be a positive change? How that can spread and that those ripples. And so I'm really glad that I met you, that we've got to talk to you. I want to know, what is your message to us and our listeners?
Oh man, that's a big question. I think what gave me the kind of inspiration and courage to share this is honestly just lived experience. And what I mean by that is, I think many people day to day experience these refining and defining moments of their lives that could drastically impact the lives of people around them. But in those moments, we often don't consider that. And so going through the things I have gone through in my life, both good and bad, and reflecting on them, I noticed that there were kind of these trends. And one of the big trends that I kept seeing was, I can't really control how I am perceived in situations, right? So when you go into a situation, whether it be your accent, whether it be your gender, whether it be your skin color, whatever it is, that is going to be perceived in some way by someone in that situation. And so I kind of had this introspective moment of my life and thought, I've gone through all this stuff. Who do I want to be perceived as? Who do I want to be perceived as? And how does that fit in to these lived experiences? And so then the opportunity to do this TEDx talk came up, and I said, you know, I am wanting to talk about that kind of lived experience some more. And so I went into it, and I'm rambling a little bit here because it was just such a big kind of, I think, defining moment for me. But like you talked, the title of the TEDx talk is about a legacy. And so I said, you know, with these experiences I've had in Myanmar specifically, I left a legacy in these communities. I had an impact in these communities. When we go into situations, whether it be as an instructor in a classroom, whether it be as an extension specialist who is responding to someone's concerns over an insect, whether it be a global health person who is focused on international work and is in the field, everything we do, every interaction we have, every conversation we have, every choice we make leaves an impact in those areas or on that person, right? And I think at the end of the day, that's what people want. People want to be remembered. People want to have an impact on something. And you will. And I think that's the bottom line. You will. Whether it's a good impact or a bad impact, I think we get to decide that. And so really that goal is saying, hey, these are my experiences. This is how I've had a negative impact before. And this is how I've had a positive impact. And this is how I think you can really choose actively to leave that positive impact. And so I think my message to your to the listeners of this amazing podcast would be that it's never too late or early to start thinking about what your legacy is going to be at the end of your life or at the end of your career, at the end of your week, whatever that looks like, the end of a trip. As we go into these experiences, I think it can redefine how we interact with people, right? I think it can redefine how we talk about bugs with people who don't know about them yet. I think it can also change how we treat people in even the simplest situations, right? I used to kind of be an a-hole growing up, just being blunt, right? I grew up in kind of an angry home sometimes, and I had a lot of kind of teenage angst that I went through. And that teenage angst just made me not very friendly. But even now, just thinking about, man, all the people, all the waiters, the waitresses, like the people in stores that I talked to that I just negatively impacted through my ignorance of what I was doing. And so it's really made me think more about my day-to-day interactions with people, because I think they add up and I think they really do leave an impact, right? Okay. A great example, you sharing that our conversation changed your experience at Pest World, right, Jody? That was not my intention. I just said, you know, I want to go into this mixer. I'm tired. It's been a really long day. Like, I'm going to go into this mixer and I'm just going to push out a little more excitement and enthusiasm and just be happy and try and talk to people and get to know people. I didn't want to because I was tired. We had been running around all day and organizing things. But I said, you know what? I'm going to do this extra bit because you never know what will happen. You never know kind of what impact you'll leave. So that's a really long-winded answer. I don't even know if it's a good answer, but it's never too late or too early to start thinking about kind of that impact and legacy that you're going to leave. And I think most people want to think about it now and should.
That's pretty awesome. Because you're a first generation college student,
yeah.
What is your best advice for someone who has not had any family members go through college and wants to? And is there support services or resources or just that little push to say, yeah, go for it. You can do it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if you're like me and you're listening and you want to go to college, but no one in your family has, it feels honestly like a mountain, like this insurmountable task. It's doable. It's absolutely doable. Yes, it can be expensive, but it doesn't have to be. I think if money is the biggest concern, community college first is an amazing option, an amazing opportunity. There are some amazing community colleges out there where you can get 2 years of your degree finished first and then transfer to a university. In terms of support and funding, I would say first, find what you want to do. If you don't know what you want to do, find a good university near you, probably an in-state university, which is going to be more affordable. Go there. And if you want to know how to get there, you want to figure that out, I would say look into the resources the university has to offer. I'm sure that you can connect with graduates or upperclassmen at that university who have been in similar situations with you. It definitely feels, especially coming from a really rural part of North Carolina, it definitely feels like an echo chamber in those communities sometimes, where you just kind of get stuck there and you do the family business thing. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I think if that's what someone really feels like their life is meant to be and what they want to do, go for it. Power to you for that. I think that's amazing. But if you've considered going to college and you're nervous about trying to kind of navigate that space, it's absolutely doable. You can even reach out to me and I will happily talk to you and encourage you and tell you to do it if that's what you want.
That's an excellent transition into me asking you, how can people find you on the web? Is there a way for folks to contact you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'll be honest. I'm not a huge social media user. My wife makes fun of me for that, but I do have a few. As Jody mentioned, I do have the TEDx talk. I totally will shamelessly plug that here. You can just go on YouTube and look up TEDx NC State Chris Hayes and you'll find it. It doesn't have many views and that's okay. I just tell people if you like it and you watch it, great. And if you think it is a quote idea worth sharing, share it. If you don't, it won't hurt my feelings, but check that out. On LinkedIn, I'm Christopher Hayes. I was telling Michael or Mike, see, I did it, Mike. I just did it. I just changed to Michael for no reason.
It's fine.
I was telling Mike earlier, Chris Hayes is a famous guy on MSNBC. So on social media, I'm usually Christopher Hayes. So Christopher Hayes on LinkedIn. And my Instagram handle is a man on a mosquito. which is cool. It's mostly just fun pictures of bugs and things. And then I'm actually building a website right now. I kind of wanted to create a good space to put pictures of outreach. So I'm really big into outreach, especially with younger kids and middle school, high school kids, teaching them about entomology and things, and also for my research. So that website is cchayes.wordpress.ncsu.edu. But that is, it's a baby website. I have a cover page. That's it. I just started like last week.
They all start somewhere. That's right. We will definitely include all of those in your show notes. I sympathize on the famous name thing. Jonathan Larson is also the creator of Rent. And so every time that comes back up again, I get weird messages. I used to get messages on Facebook from people that wanted to friend me because I had the same name as a playwright.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. It was shameless. It was weird. But I sympathize a little bit. So check out Chris or Christopher on all of those different platforms. You can find us, arthro-pod.blogspot.com. You can find the show on Twitter, arthro_podshow. You can also find us on all of your favorite podcatcher apps. We are arthro-pod on all of those as well. You got to include the dash or you won't find us. You get all these other weird things. I am also on Twitter occasionally, and I am at Bugman John.
I'm at Jody Bugsme, UNL.
And you're not going to confuse me with anybody because there's only three Michael Scavarlas in North America and all of us are related. I'm on Twitter at mscavarla36.
And that is true. He's done the research on that. I've seen the data. So it's a rarity. With that, we thank you for tuning in. We hope you liked the episode. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another great episode of Entomology Entertainment. And thank you, Chris, for joining us.
Thank you, guys. This was awesome.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging. Hey, guess what?
What?
Gotta go.
Bye.
Bye.
I was gonna do my thing where I was like, hey, one more thing and then hang up on you, but Jody usually gets mad at me.
Where'd he go? He said there was one more thing. What happened?
I can't play with your emotions like that.
Say one more thing. I'm not letting you go.
I'm just gonna do the Irish goodbye.
You did too.
You did. All right. I'm gonna go eat lunch.
Okay, bye Mike.
Bye, Jody.